we're going to go ahead and start the official venue for this morning. Again, I want to thank each and every one of you for being here this morning. I really appreciate it, as I imagine all of you do as well. And thank you for being here, too. The panel discussion will consist of 3 to 4 questions, with each legislator having the opportunity to respond. We will start each question with whomever answered last. We will also give you each a 2-minute time frame to couch a summary at the end of the formal questions. There will be 4 questions. Each candidate will have 1 minute to answer, with 30 and 15 second warning, and finally a stop sign, 55 minutes. And Jen is going to be the person to help you with that. You have a good elbow. Judy's got a good elbow, so we're good here. And then if there is time, which hopefully there will be, we'll open it up for audience questions to follow, of course, time permitting. All right. Well, question number 1. And Judy, we'll go ahead and start here and work our way down, if that's okay with all of you. For the next session, what are 1 or 2 of the most important issues you will personally work on? Warm you up.
So as you know, we are actually building in transportation the largest construction for this biennium ever in the state's history. So we are out there working so hard, and you probably see it all over. But those are bonded funds. So in order to get any new programs, we're going to be working on new revenue, and it will be it will include reforming and making savings. It will include tolling. It will include revenue from fees. And probably will include gas tax, even though it's a declining revenue stream.
Thank you, Judy. Ross.
I hope she doesn't start timing until I actually start talking.
No fair.
Next year, we're going to face a difficult budget cycle, and I don't expect us to have a significant dependence on new revenue next year. So one of the major efforts that I'll be working on is dealing with budget issues next year, trying to figure out how do we continue to deal with a revenue stream that's, for this biennium at least, we collected $1 billion less from Washington taxpayers than in the previous biennium, which is the first time that's happened since the 50s. We're going to have to figure out how to deal with that next year. We also have a lot of other policy work that we have to do around local government. I'd still like to finish annexing all of the little pieces into cities in King County. Thank you, Kirkland, for taking on a yeoman's work there. And we have a lot of follow-up from learning that we did this year, a lot of studies where we're looking at how funds flow inside companies to try and see if we can make the B&O work better for the business community.
I don't think we will have a good picture of what the legislature's focus will be until after the election in November, not just because we won't know yet who will be in the legislature, but because there'll be a number of initiatives on the ballot, not the least of which is one which would privatize workman's comp, privatization of the liquor system. Both of those topics are things that we attempted to reform in the last session and couldn't even get a hearing. So I, for one, am not particularly in favor of privatizing workman's comp, but I absolutely believe that we have to reform the system. So I think we'll know the second or third week in November, about what our particular emphasis will be. But I think certainly it centers around the budget.
Actually, there's a microphone.
Yeah. So public schools are the paramount duty of the state. It's something that I'm deeply attached to in my committee assignments and my special assignment to the Quality Education Council. It's also the most significant portion of the budget. We have a number of work groups that are looking at the financing. We're telling school districts to do more with less. We're in the middle of some very significant long-term historic reforms. So I will continue to be working on those specific reforms, getting more efficiency out of the K-12 system.
I don't sit on any of the fiscal committees on purpose. I have a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old. I like to spend my weekends at home sometimes. But I'm going to continue work on justice system improvements, sort of ranging as widely, continuing domestic violence, strengthening domestic violence laws, working on impaired driving, other things like reforming the garnishment statute to make collections more efficient and to allow debtors to move on in their lives, things like that. And then education, particularly early learning. Early learning work group has just been established, and I'm one of the two legislators on that. And we're basically going to be establishing the architecture for a new system of preschool for all kids in the state. I'm very excited about that.
The budget's going to dominate everything that we do down in Olympia this next year. We're probably looking at somewhere between a $4 and $5 billion deficit, and that's coming on the heels of, you know, basically a $12 billion deficit that we just have solved over the past 2 years. That is going to dominate everything we do. A couple of the other areas, education, we have the Race to the Top contest from the federal government. I guess I'm probably not too optimistic in our application because I think there's other states out there doing a lot more things than we are. But we're going to have to learn from what those other states, whoever does win, what it's going to take to win on that. The other thing is make sure that we stay diligent on our oversight of 520. We made major progress on that this year, but especially in a year where the budget's going to dominate, we need to make sure that that continues forward. And then last but not least, but I think probably the most important issue out there, because I think it dominates everything out there, and that's campaign finance reform. The way that we finance our campaigns is ridiculous. It takes all of our time, and it really does get to the point where that is way too much of our focus.
What they all said. The budget, of course, is going to dominate the session. Unlike the smarter seatmate, Representative Goodman, I drew the short straw and actually am on the Finance Committee with Ross Hunter. So that will take up a lot of time in terms of trying to figure out an appropriate revenue mix for the state. But a couple of policy issues that I will be focusing on. Representative Eddy mentioned the LNI system. I will be one of two in the caucus that are focused on working on LNI reform for the next coming session. There are a number of reforms that the LNI system is desperately in need of. I can tell you, as Deb mentioned, we counted up since 2005, there have been 25 bills introduced on LNI reform, and not a single one of them has ever even seen the light of day. So it's time we did that. One last thing I'll mention, I don't know if you heard on the radio this morning, water allocation issues in eastern Washington. Get ready. It's coming, and it is going to be ugly.
Representative Springer, we'll start with you being the first one on this one, and then just open it up for whatever order you want to take. After the budget, what are the biggest issues that will affect the East Side business community that the legislator will have to address in 2011?
After the budget and after transportation improvements on 405 and 520, quite frankly, I think, and I'm sure Rodney Tom would like to speak to this as well, is going to be finding adequate funding for our higher education system. It is just getting hammered right now, and I was just listening to Rodney a moment ago, and he's got some numbers he can probably share with you. But while we have tried desperately to hang on to funding for K-12, and I think in the face of what we've faced, we've done an okay job there. But higher ed has taken the brunt, the community and technical college system, I think we've done a reasonable job of hanging on to that. But in terms of really preparing people for the jobs you all have and the jobs you don't even know you're going to have 10, 15 years from now, we have got to figure out a way to get our higher ed system back on track. Like Larry said, higher ed, I think, is going to be key to make sure that we have a workforce that can compete in a global economy. If you look at the numbers, if you take from 2004 to 2011, K through 12 spending is up about 31%. GAU, or Security Lifeline, or whatever euphemism we want to give it these days, is up 131%. Four-year institutions up 0.2%. I mean, it's killing us. If you look at the product life cycles today, I mean, they're 3 to 4 years. So 20 years from now, the basis of our economy is going to be something that comes out of the University of Washington that none of us understand, none of us know about. And here we are today shortchanging that. And I just think it's ridiculous the path that we're going on that. And if we don't start focusing on the university, you know, we've already lost our president, but from there on, you're going to start losing some of the top professors that we've had that really do make that a world-class institution.
I do agree on higher ed. I just think we need to keep our eye on the ball on 520. We've made a lot of progress, but there's still so much uncertainty, and so we're really going to have to focus in every session until this thing's built.
Yeah.
Are we supposed to all anti? I mean, this could go
a while. You don't have to.
Okay. So. Everything they said, but for your business in the short run, the thing that will present itself to you are the implications of whether we reform workman's comp or not, if you've got workplace safety issues. Also, the question of unemployment insurance. If unemployment stays high over a long period of time, then our system is the formula is such that you will see further increases in your UI. So we need to make sure that we are creating jobs so that that bottom line is not impacted any worse than it has to be. The problem with higher ed is that as long as we can import degrees, you as a business may not feel the impact of what's happening in higher ed. Your kids and your kids' kids will. And it's caring about those future generations as opposed to the short-term concerns that make that make higher ed a really, really tough subject.
So I'd love to talk about higher ed, but I don't want to use up all of my remaining 42 seconds. And I agree with these guys. It's a big deal, and we have a lot of work to do. In the immediate short term, there's a couple of issues that are going to affect the business community on the east side a lot. We're going to have a big construction project starting on 520. We've funded the construction on the east side. We've funded the pontoon construction. We've agreed on the final design, or we've agreed mostly on the final design on the west side, with still a lot of Sturm und Drang to go along there. But we haven't funded the west side, and we're going to need to do that. Otherwise, we still have an expensive floating parking lot. And so I want to make sure that we stay focused on that, because that the traffic on 520 affects the entire east side business community. The other big deal is something that's come out of the other Washington, which is dealing with health care. The new health care plan has to get integrated into the state funding model, the whole state Medicaid model, and it'll be a big deal. I do have a short question. I have a question I want to ask later.
So I always get to I just want to say amen to what DevEddie said, because we all worked pretty diligently trying to get workman's comp on the table and couldn't do it. I just want you to know I do other things besides transportation. But real quickly, Ross is right about keeping our eye on 520. I am feeling much more confident about the west side. Anecdotally, I'm hearing that neighborhoods are telling the people who were the most adamant against the 520 on the west side all along, telling those leaders to step down, to stand back and let this go. They love the boulevard approach. They're the people who were not involved in the threatening to have lawsuits are now feeling comfortable. So the funding still is up in the air. We have to work with the federal government. Whatever we do, we'll probably have to include I-90. Right now, the federal government has turned down requests for corridors that are not spending the money on that corridor. So we think we can go forward with that, but it'd be very careful about how we word it.
Well, Meg, did you want to talk, or the next question?
Sure. Actually, why don't you start me off with the next one? I didn't realize we're supposed to answer every question.
No, you don't. You don't. I just wanted to give you the opportunity.
I'll be happy to jump in on your
next. He just wants 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, his minutes.
You'll have 2 minutes in a few minutes. How about that?
Can you hold the microphone?
Oh, sorry.
You bet. Speaking of 520, first of all, I want to thank you for the hard work that has been put into 520, because that has been a very big project. And so I know each and every one of you have put a lot of work into this, more so than others. But thank you very much for that. Some headway has been made. Yeah. So keeping along this topic of 520, and to keep the momentum going, what steps do you see that need to be taken specifically in 2011 to keep the momentum going and to keep progress moving forward with 520?
I actually want to pass on that. We actually have some really, it would be, well, I've played a role with the Eastside legislators my role has been very supportive to Representative Clifford, Eddie, and Springer. So, okay.
You want to start with me?
Sure.
That was the last? No. Give me all the minutes. You know, I'm feeling so comfortable with 520, and we're sort of fighting a battle on the tunnel. So, in some ways, 520 is just a place where you need to keep your eyes on it and make sure that somebody doesn't step forward. The mayor was the big fly in the ointment. He's stood back and gone over to the tunnel now. But I do think the funding will require us to be diligent for the last $2 billion. Right now, we're getting ready to go out to bids on the east side. And the way it will be put forward is, here's our project. Come in and give us your bid and tell us how much you can do, because we don't quite have enough to do the whole amount. But the bids are coming in so far under budget that we think we can actually get almost the whole thing done with the amount of money that's being saved. So we got good bidding environment. We have savings from the other things that have gone out to bid. And I think we're in a very good place.
I just want to mention one quirky thing. Am I the only lawyer? Wow. Sorry.
As if that's a good thing.
I'm the only smart lawyer. A little too smart. The tolling bill established in the Department of Transportation a brand new quasi-executive adjudicatory function. I just think that all the violations that are going to be going through should be going through the court system, through the municipal district court system. They're functioning. You know, this is what they do. I don't know if we're going to be able to change this, but it's going to be a terrible waste to try to establish a whole new court system, basically, within the Department of Transportation. And there's some political reasons why it happened, but I'm going to continue grousing about it.
Yeah.
I think the one thing that we do need to do as far as a public is make sure that we continue to congratulate the Seattle City Council, because they really have stepped up to a whole nother level with what we're seeing in the mayor's office. And I think with their continued pressure, I think that we will make sure that this does go through. The other thing that I think we need to make sure as an East Side community that we do is, when we have these cost savings, that not every dollar that's saved gets to be spent on the West Side. Okay, if there's dollars saved, and not that we're going to have excess dollars, but you know, the East Side is just as important as the West Side, and we have things that we could add on. You know, we have the 124th off-ramp, on-ramp interchange there. So there's a lot of things that we could be doing with excess dollars, if there are excess dollars. So I think we need to be very careful when it comes to cost savings, that if there are cost savings, those don't add into construction creep solely on the West Side.
I want to address what my esteemed colleague, the smart lawyer on the panel, said. We did have a difference of opinion amongst us about the adjudication of violations. I do appreciate that there have been some lawsuits in other states about the implementation of administrative adjudication of toll violations. What we are hopeful of is that we will learn the lessons that have been learned in other states like California, and our system will be properly administered so that we won't trample on people's constitutional rights, and it will be, I think, in the long run, much cheaper to do it, this task administratively than through the courts.
$284 million.
I'll be blunter. I disagree with Roger. I sit on the board that oversees computer projects for the state. It's my one sort of digital boy activity in the legislature. And the King County court system can't handle 6,000 bills a day for people who go over 520 who don't have a transponder. These are not violations. This is a billing activity. People drive across the bridge. They need to pay the toll. Sometimes we collect it right there because we bing their account. Sometimes we send them a bill. This is the billing system. If they want to appeal it all the way to the courts for $350, they're welcome to do that. But I think this is actually a billing collection system, and it'll work much better in DOT than it will in the court system, which has, unfortunately, for the past couple of years, been completely unable to build a new computer system. The other thing that we have to do is we really have to pay attention to the permitting and making sure that this bridge does, in fact, get permitted, not just on the east side, but also in Seattle. A lot of work to do there. There's still a lot of opportunity for theater on 520.
I will admit that courts don't know how to handle computers.
Does anyone else want to comment on before we move on? There is a fourth question here, but I think you have asked it. I'll go ahead and ask it, but I think it has been addressed, and that's what steps are you taking to make sure a business in Washington will remain viable and productive in the future?
Let me take the opportunity to reiterate some of the work we did in the last session that should help. We're going to get a lot of heat in the coming months for having raised taxes. But what sometimes gets lost in that debate over the revenue package that we raised, that $800 million, is that about 300, and Ross may correct my numbers here, but I think about 300 million of that was the closure or the reform of what would otherwise be referred to as tax loopholes, which gave unfair advantages to out-of-state businesses. So, in fact, part of the revenue package that derives revenue to the state was an effort to treat companies that compete with you that are out-of-state and to treat them equally and subject them to the same tax package that you all face. So it gets lost sometimes in the rhetoric around, you know, pop and gum taxes, but that was part of what we tried to do too.
Whenever we talk about business competitiveness, one of the big things you talk about is tax policy, and the overall business, both business climate and the tax climate. And we hear about unemployment taxes, which are high in Washington. We're a relatively high wage state, which is part of that. Part of it is we have a relatively high benefit package. We blocked any changes to the benefit package this year that would have raised unemployment taxes. I expect us to continue to do that in the future. We have work to do on the L&I part. When you want to look at the tax climate for Washington, for some people, our tax system is terrible. For some people, you know, this is actually pretty good. When I look at stuff from the Tax Foundation, which are the people that bring you Tax Freedom Day, so they're not always my favorite reference, they actually rate our tax system pretty high for business competitiveness in the top 10. And if you're a high-margin business, this is a fabulous place to do business. We have to do work to even that out and figure out where do we want to have our tax incidents occur and where do we want to not have it occur and be a little bit more thoughtful about how we approach the overall tax system. It takes a while to figure this out and be able to do it strategically.
Yeah, very good. I'll just add on that quickly, I think. To the point that, you know, businesses, I think, really just want kind of government to stay out of the way. They'd like to do their line of business. They'd like to not have a lot of regulations. So where we're doing government smarter and better, where we're closing loopholes, which we talked about, and there's some more that we really need to get to, that's creating an equal playing field. The LNI piece is pretty important. And then just doing smarter, better government. And some areas where that comes to mind is how we do in fiscal policy on managing junior taxing districts. New Mexico, for instance, requires all those savings to be placed in community chartered banks. Then you're talking about using taxpayer dollars in institutions that are fallen by Washington state rules. And we end up, taxpayers win on both sides of that, both on the rate of return as well as on more competitive borrowing rates. So those are just more areas.
I just want to make a brief add-on to what Larry was talking about in terms of plugging the loopholes. The trigger was really pulled when we temporarily suspended Initiative 960, which another incarnation is likely to be on the ballot this year. And so that's what allowed us to plug the loopholes. So there's this confusion that, and I suppose some of us at this table don't agree with the two-thirds, but nevertheless, all of this is sort of wound up together. We couldn't have plugged the loopholes if we hadn't suspended 960.
So when I became chair, one of the top, actually when I got elected about 8 years ago, the top issue for business was transportation. I don't think that's the top issue anymore. So even though I'm talking about it, I just want you to know I understand because I agree with everybody on what has been said. However, we will be caught up on transportation funding with 960. Some of the things that we might come forward with new revenue would have to go to the ballot. Some of the things will be fees. And so we're looking at a very different vision of how we go forward. It will not be gas tax solely, gas tax based. I also think that we have to be very clear that we don't go forward with new revenue if we have a stumbling economy elsewhere. People will not, even though it's a different budget, it's a different place, different priority. I think that it's gauche to go out there and start talking about new transportation dollars and probably would have to push it out a couple years.
I think one of the things we need to be really careful about this upcoming session is how we interpret what happens with some of these initiatives. If you look at like the LNI initiative, I personally think that that is way too complicated of an issue for an initiative process. But too often what we'll hear is when there's confusions on initiatives, people vote no. Well, if people vote no on that initiative, that does not mean that they like the current system and that they don't want us to do anything. And there's going to be enormous pressure that that's what that vote means. Everybody tries to self-interpret these things to their advantage. And I think that we need to be dead fast in our approach to that, in that we don't misinterpret the people's views on a lot of these initiatives, no matter which way they go.
Well, thank you for answering the questions that have been put in front of you or asked of you. I would like to now give each one of you an opportunity, 2 minutes, to make any kind of closing summary that you would like to make. And it can be up to 2 minutes. You can take the whole 2 minutes or as long as you want. So, whoever wants to start.
I'll just start and get it. I thought that maybe I should address the ferry issues because part of our new funding package will be to help fund replacement of the ferries. And there is so much on television about the gross gaming of the system. Just so you understand, we actually passed a bill to change the negotiation process for all the labor on the ferries in 3 days at the very end of the session or right at the end of the regular session. It was a place where labor was actually embarrassed and came to the table and worked very well with us. And we took away baseball arbitration and all kinds of issues. The things that are on the news now are things that were negotiated over years and years and years that we could not touch. Because if you go to negotiation and it's baseball arbitration, you lose. So the one thing that we have now is a new playing field. The things that are in the news, we have to get them taken care of so that we actually held on raising ferry fares. until we get it straightened out because it's so unfair. And I think that's the kind of thing that we start with on before you go out and try and do anything as far as new revenue. You have to reform the system. And that's the same thing that we're talking about with workman's comp. If you don't start where the issues are that people care about, then you don't get their permission to do the cuts or to raise revenue. So I think that's the most important thing to me is that we make sure that we're cleaning up all the problems before we go out and start talking about new revenue.
Well, I'm talking to a business audience today, and this is a I'm trying not to give my normal stump speech on what's important to me in the legislature because I personally spend a lot of time focusing on education policy and funding, and I really wanted to stay on the topic today of what affects the business community. And the initiatives that Rodney mentioned are a serious thing. Honestly, as far as I can tell, looking at the LNI thing, I think there's some interesting stuff in it, but it sure looks to me like the instantiation of a fight between the BIAW and the master builders of King and Snohomish County, where one side's smacking on the other. And it looks some of it looks a little childish, but I don't understand LNI well enough to make a judgment on that inside. We have work to do on budget. I have some initiatives that I'm working on to try and rip out a lot of the bureaucracy in the system. And the two words that I'm using to drive this is both one touch and paperless. And an example of that is I'm working with all the cities in King County, and we're going to try and consolidate B&O payment and collection. So we have one local B&O tax return instead of 11 in King County for any reasonably sized business. And we can consolidate across all the cities the auditing and all of the collection mechanism. It'd be simpler for business. It'll work better for the cities. We'll have better compliance. Trying to do that. We're trying to do that at the state level as well. We're trying to drive an effort to combine the tax collection parts from LNI, from unemployment, and from revenue so you have one place to go on the web, one account, one system, one check to write. The goal would be to make it simpler and to have a lot fewer people and a lot less computer stuff. I'm work on a tax increment financing tool because one of the things that's happened as a result of our economic difficulties is a lot of the funds that local governments use to pay for infrastructure aren't available. And we need to make sure that our local governments aren't dependent on state largesse and can bootstrap themselves to do that. We also have a lot of work to do to focus on our jobs agenda of how do we both do state-driven construction, which is the only non-residential construction going on right now in the commercial side, but also how we have jobs in the private sector as well. And a lot of that's around tax policy, and I'm out of time. All right.
Happens. And he could have gone on. Everything that he said, but I want to back up for just a little bit. And while we're talking in very positive terms, particularly about the things that we can go back in the next session and do to make your life simpler, and I want to underscore those. I absolutely support them. I also think that there is that we're avoiding what is a big ugly, which is that there is a projection that we will have an additional $5 billion shortfall to address in January. When you add that to the fact that if we have a double dip in the stock market and our various retirement portfolios yet again tank, we are going to be faced with a financial situation in the upcoming biennium that will not be as easily dealt with as the last one. And that's not saying that we all had fun the last 2 years. We did not. But the task was doable without dealing with a lot of sacred cows. Those sacred cows will be front and center in the next 2 years, I fear. It will not be, it was tense down there at lots of points. But at the end of the day, we made it work on the back of invented or printed federal money. The feds will be reluctant to print any more money, which means we're going to, and they shouldn't, which means that we are, that those sacred cows, like carrying retiree health benefits as a cash item, will have to be dealt with. And let me tell you that we have lots more of the people over 50 who are down in Olympia banging on our doors than we have kids under 12. that's just my little hobby horse that really irritates me.
So, as Ross said, this is a business group, but it's also community members, community leaders, and a really nice community. And preserving that's important. We're also parents here. And, you know, what Ross talked about, a little bit about infrastructure, I just want to tie in another thing, and that's not everyone that – there's a reason why this community is so nice, and it's the policies at the county and the city level that have done. But there are people that take shortcuts. And so we need polluter pay requirements. And we had a bill last year that I'd like to see move again that would link some of that polluter pay for infrastructure for cleaning up, for collecting the oil and gas runoff, for protecting the Puget Sound. We have a really upside-down policy where we fee the generation of hazardous waste, dangerous waste and hazardous waste, and you pay a fee based on the volume of how much waste you generate, unless you're really big, in which case you get a volume discount. That needs to be turned around so that you actually pay the more you generate. So there's little things that we can reform like that. One last one that I've been working for 4 years, which is welfare reform, government welfare reform. King County is one of the donor counties in Washington State. And I'm not saying we need to pull the plug and all the welfare we're driving out the rest of the state. That wouldn't be quite right. But what we do need to have is some reform and accountability there. We drive, King County drives money around the state in ways that people don't, you know, most people aren't even aware of, whether it's through funding into the public schools, through levy welfare, whether it's diversions where they just don't pay the taxes that they're due. And what we have to do is put that front and center and require, I think, the welfare recipients to be aware of that, to own that, and to vote on it and approve of that. And then lastly, local dollars that are raised are 100% spent in our community. And so I've been working on trying to make it so that the money that we raise stays here in King County.
Thinking about the difficulty and controversy of the last session, on the way over here this morning, I envisioned legislators slowly roasting on a spit at Matt's rotisserie grill. I didn't know if you thought about the irony of that this morning.
But, I hope that's not on the menu.
Yeah. Finger licking good. The upcoming session faces another deficit. And I have to say, as more of an observer, I'm a lobbyist actually within the legislature, hoping to be pleasantly surprised in terms of the budget. But my colleagues do the best that they can, and it's really clear and how difficult it is. In the meanwhile, there are not a lot of legislators who know or care a lot about the justice system and that it's not working well. And we can achieve a lot of savings. And it's not just justice, it's public safety, public health in general, sort of the basic fundamentals of the policy pyramid. We can't even get to education unless we make sure that the necessities are provided. So I'm working on that, you know, housing the homeless, making sure that kids are ready for school, and fed and healthy and so forth, that people are safe in their homes and safe on the streets, that level of security. If you take a look at the numbers, could achieve up to $1 billion in either savings and or revenue by reforming the justice system.
So again, I mean, it's really going to come down to budget. It really is going to dominate everything that we do. And I think you're going to really be looking at two big constraints. One, as other speakers have said, there's not going to be any rescue from the federal end. I think the federal government has looked at the bond markets, and there's just stimulus is not going to be there. The other thing, I think we will see the sun of 960. So as far as from the state standpoint, new revenue is probably going to be off the table. So what that leaves us with is we truly do need to address some of these issues that I think we should have addressed this past session. We can't have sacred cows out there. And if you look at one particular When we did the budget 2 years ago, when we set up the employee health care, we had budgeted $763 per employee as far as the employer contribution. 2 months later, the governor negotiates a deal that's about $910, $915. You can't do that in this economy. It wasn't a great economy then, and you can't do that. So some of these, when we talk about deficits, they're self-inflicted deficits. If you look at the bow wave of what that did, we put in $65 million in this budget to cover that. Well, the $65 million was petty cash compared to the true cost of that. The real deficit in that health care was $220 million. And the way that we made up that is we use accrued payments and we use our cash reserve, which you can't do. The insurance commissioner wrote the governor a letter saying, if you were a private insurance company, you know, I'd shut you down. So if you look at what that creates in the future, that's a $500 million bow wave coming forward, and that's before medical inflation. So we're going to have to do a lot of things that are going to be really tough, but they're things that need to be addressed. So it's going to be one of those issues where, again, I know my time's out, but campaign finance reform is fundamental because too often the question that is being asked is not what is in the best interest of the citizens of Washington State, but, and both parties do this, there's nobody that is, you know, without sin, but who is going to fund my campaign in November? And that is never the question that should ever be asked.
One of the things that that's certainly been mentioned here a number of times, you know, are all the issues that surround the budget. And I think Deb coined the term sacred cows. And there, when we get back down there in January, as has been said, the methodology we used to fix a $12 billion hole over the last 2 years, those are gone. We don't have those fund transfers. We don't have that federal money anymore. So there are going to be less choices. Which means we're going to have to take a very, very close look at where we have the opportunity to make some changes. And quite frankly, that's employees and benefits. Yep. We are 70% driven by employees. Every city, every county, every government basically has that same percentage. Government is people doing, providing service. That's what we are. We don't make stuff. We hire people to provide service. So you're always people driven. That's where the number is. That's where the fight's going to be. I want to mention one more thing, though, in closing, and that is one of the things we have to keep in mind, and many of us sometimes lose track of it, we have a phrase in our caucus that we use over and over again, and we mean it, and it's simply the phrase called One Washington. And what it tries to remind us is that while it's easy sitting here in beautiful Redmond, Washington, talking to a bunch of folks who are actively engaged in their community, working in businesses, there are parts of this state that aren't so pretty and have real needs that many of us here in Redmond and Kirkland don't always understand. For example, I've been involved a lot in the last several years in ag issues in eastern Washington. The agricultural industry in Washington is the single largest employer in the state. And we had better be paying attention to what I mentioned earlier, and that is water allocation issues in eastern Washington. Not something we much know about over here, but we have to pay attention to that. Tax policy for cities in border states like Spokane and Vancouver, critical for them. We don't always understand that here. So there is a bigger playing field out there than the east side.
Thank you. We really appreciate you answering our questions and also giving us a summary of what's important to you and what you're going to be working on. We do have a few minutes to open it up for any questions. So how we'll do this is with the microphone. Just signal to me that you've got a question. I'll hand the microphone and then give as many people that want to answer it an opportunity, and we'll go from there. So, Mike.
You tiptoed with the issue, it's kind of a two-prong. A, are we really going to be able to, willing to, and go to opening up contracts as well as pulling the off-balance sheet pension issues and get those addressed rather than continuing to hide them?
Yes, is the short answer on contracts, because we won't have it. we won't have even the ghost of a chance to avoid dealing with some of those issues that have been intractable to solve before. We couldn't get the votes. Pension issues are not off budget. They're very clearly on budget. We have huge obligations to display our long-term pension obligations. On my blog site on rosshunter.info, there's an article that came out from the Council of State Governments a while ago showing Washington's relative funding of pension obligations compared to other states, and this is 2008 data. We were actually fully funded at that time for our current pension obligations. There's one fund that we are still making catch-up contributions to. We're in a lot better situation than other states. I don't think we're still 100% funded because that's 2 years ago data. But that's pensions. And what Rodney talked about is the change for most states where you have to look at the future cost. You have to capitalize the future costs of health care benefits and not pay it on cash. And yeah, we're going to have to do that. I agree.
Some of us were there last year. We couldn't get the votes, no matter how obnoxious we made ourselves.
And we did.
Hopefully the fact that there is nowhere else to go. It's important, frankly, that the governor be involved and take her role seriously. And I believe that she's vacillated too long.
No, we're absolutely going to have to address those with the numbers involved and with no other alternative. But I think that, you know, we shouldn't have to have a gun to our head to make smart decisions. And I guess that's the frustrating part to me is we're supposed to be leaders, and leadership is about doing things before you're forced to do them. But that doesn't seem to be the nature of where we are in politics, whether that be at the state level or at the federal level.
Anyone else have a
Good morning. Thank you for being with us this morning and your public service. And a question for whoever wants to jump in, but from a statewide and regional perspective, are there unique qualities to the Lake Washington School District and our learning communities of Kirkland, Redmond, and Sammamish that highlight the role of public education in local economic development, not just vitality, but continued development? Any unique qualities that Lake Washington has that makes us exceptional across the state?
Sure. You have great demographics.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, this is the most depressing statistic in education, which is that the educational attainment of a child can best be predicted by the zip code in which that child was born. And I don't have numbers in the last couple years in Lake Washington. The last time I looked, the percentage of free and reduced price lunch was in low single digits. And the statewide average is about 36%. And you do very well, even with low, with really great demographics. I mean, it's a well-performing district, again, even with, when you take into account the demographics. But the demographics are going to have you outperform the rest of the state almost no matter what else happens.
There's something a little more to it than that. Lake Washington does have good demographics, but we also outperform. If you look at even just Bellevue to the south, who has an ability to raise more local money because of grandfathering issues, Lake Washington is in the bottom 10% of per pupil funding. If you look at all the revenue streams added together, federal, state, and local, bottom 10%. Yet what they've done with the learning communities that you talked about and creating choice schools and now expanding their choice program, they're kind of inventing a charter school model within a public school system and showing some of best of breed in partnering with homeschoolers, partnering with online learning, partnering with alternative learning environments, and creating these other magnet schools.
I just want to give a credit to current Lake Washington School District leadership and the foundation, but also have a tip my hat to North Shore with the great community involvement there and Riverview out in the Snoqualmie Valley. I mean, there's a lot of really good school districts. It's not just zip code. It's actually activity in the Broca's area of the brain that is stimulated by socioeconomic status. So, yeah, we're really lucky to be here on the east side.
Any other questions? We probably have time for one more.
I should learn how to be more smarmy. Those were better answers.
Smarmy. Senator Smarmy.
The extra...
Yeah, I don't know if that helped either.
The extra session last, and the regular session last term created a lot of anxiety and extra meetings and confusion, and the result was that lack of transparency that you're all being blamed for. And I wondered if you have a plan for making sure that public hearings have ballot titles and notification and some of that issue. Can you address that?
Let me take that. I mean, it's my bills mostly.
It's your bills.
Let me talk a little bit about the process that bills go through. There was some concern about how the bills would be introduced. I think they were called ghost bills. And we have a set of deadlines that have to get met for when bills are introduced and when they're heard. And often as you get towards the end, particularly towards the end of a special session, trying to get yourself to the place where you have an agreement that you can turn into a bill is very difficult. And we try and create some bill titles, a variety of titles, so that when you do come up with an agreement, you can put it into bill form and pass it forward without having a title that's needlessly broad. That would then be subject to lots of amendments that would potentially damage the agreement. And so we'll often move a couple of titles forward. Every legislature for the umpty-umpt year has moved those titles through just so that you're prepared to implement an agreement. So I don't think it's really a lack of transparency. We're the most transparent state government in the state, in the country.
What this highlights is that for those of us up here who have been on city governments, we have dealt with a process which is a lot easier to be transparent within. We study things, we toss around different solutions before we ever ask staff to write the ordinance by which we implement that solution. The legislature is a completely different animal. We have three different, the two houses and the governor, all of whom have to agree. We have an constitutionally described process that is subject to some rules that are so arcane that even those of us who went to law school don't understand half the time. So while I appreciate the criticism, what I also have to say is that this has been going on for years. It is part and parcel of the institution. Yes, we could probably do better, but I doubt that we're going to do a whole lot better unless you want to change the Constitution.
The last thing I'd mention in that regard, from my point of view, is the what we call ghost bills or title-only bills is actually inherent in that process is a protection. And the protection is we have rules in the institution that do not allow us to amend on provisions to a bill that do not apply directly to the title of the bill. So that gets you away from what you know they like to refer to in D.C. as earmarking. That can't happen here. You cannot add an education policy to a transportation bill. So if you have a transportation issue that's coming up, you have to have a bill ready that is a transportation bill, and you may not have all of the components of that bill ready to go by the time it's time for a hearing. So there is a protection in that process as well so that we don't get carried away with just amending anything onto any bill.
And for the same reason, a number of initiatives have been overthrown because of this one subject rule, which is one of the constitutional provisions. I was going to comment on my freshman term in the legislature when bills were sprung on us in the caucus without a lot of vetting and to, you know, great consternation. And that has not been happening. So I'm thinking lately. So if it's been happening, if things have been more transparent in the caucus, despite our disagreements, it's interesting that the public perceives that it's been less transparent.
I would just like to make a comment that some of us did feel like we had things sprung on us. If you're not right in the right committees to know what's coming forward. However, the ghost bills, I think, were more onerous to you because they were around taxes that might get put on you, and I think the people who felt like they were getting something sprung on them, that's why you had the anxiety, because I don't think any of you had the anxiety of the bill that was title only that we did for reforming the ferry negotiation. None of you could care about that. But it was a ghost bill. It had a title only, and it went forward because we were working behind the scenes, and when we all came out, we could put it in there, and everybody could see what it was. I think it was because we were doing things that you guys were really, really concerned about.
Mm-hmm. So can I add one bit, since I'm the tax guy, and I know my minute was up. One of the things that I went out of my way to do this year was to have hearings on as many bills as possible on the tax front, because it was clear that we were going to raise some revenue, and I really wanted to have the vetting that we get from public hearing. So almost every single piece of policy that appeared in the final revenue bill had a hearing either in that bill or in any number of other bills. The governor introduced many bills, and I, as the chair of the committee, even though I disagreed with many of them, was the prime sponsor of them because it's the job of the finance chair. And we had many, many hearings on all the elements of these bills, with the sort of notable exception of the pop tax, which, because I didn't like it. And as a result, it's screwed up. The implementation of it's incredibly painful. And so in hindsight, I wish I'd done that as well, even though I was really trying to kill the bill.
Well, with respect to time, we're going to bring this to a close. First of all, I want to thank all the hard work that you've done down in Olympia and will continue to do this year, and really appreciate your time this morning. So thank you. I want to thank each and every one of you for attending, taking time out of your busy day, as we are all involved in business or running business. So thank you for taking time to be here and asking the good questions. Also, I'd like to take an opportunity to thank the Redmond staff and the Kirkland Chamber staff to put on this event. It's not easy. A lot of work goes on behind the scenes, and so thank you to the staff for doing that. And also thank you to Matt's for hosting this. Thank you to Jenna for the accountability of the time. Appreciate that. And then for future events, for the Redmond Chamber of Commerce, please refer to what's on your table here. And then you can also go to the websites for both the Redmond Chamber and the Kirkland Chamber to view upcoming events. So thank you again, and have a wonderful day and wonderful rest of your week.